Good day, and welcome to the Social Security National Disability Forum on COVID-19 and SSA Programs, Mental Health Effect on Adults and Children Conference Call. The National Disability Forum is a public forum and may include representatives of the press, so any statement or comment made during the forum may be considered on the record. All lines will be in a listen-only mode for the duration of the call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Stephen Evangelista, Assistant Deputy Commissioner, Office of Retirement Disability Policy, Social Security Administration. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Travis, and good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for joining us today. My name is Stephen Evangelista, and it's my great privilege to serve as the Assistant Deputy Commissioner for Retirement and Disability Policy at the Social Security Administration. And I have the pleasure of welcoming you all today to the 17th National Disability Forum. On behalf of Commissioner Saul and SSA executives and everyone at the Social Security Administration, we hope that each of you are safe and doing well. The topic of today's forum is COVID-19 and SSA's programs, specifically the mental health effect on adults and children. Before we dive into this important and critical topic for our agency, as Travis noted, I'd like to let everyone know that the National Disability Forum is a public forum and may include representatives from the press, so any statements or comments made during the forum may be considered on the record. This call is being recorded and will be available on the National Disability Forum's website within 2 weeks from today. I'd also like to extend a sincere thank you to our moderator, Dr. Bob Drake, and to all the panelists for taking time to prepare their presentations, for sharing their research and knowledge of COVID-19 with us today. It's now my great honor to welcome and introduce the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration, Commissioner Andrew Saul. Commissioner Saul was sworn in June of 2019, and since day one, Commissioner Saul has made improving the agency's customer service his top priority. Prior to becoming the commissioner, he served as the chair of the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board and has also served in state and local government as well as nonprofit organizations. He is the recipient of the Next Avenue's 2020 Influencers in Aging and has been laser-focused on protecting the public during the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition, Commissioner Saul has prioritized this forum and has instituted unprecedented engagements with stakeholders, such as ongoing national calls to learn how organizations can help the Social Security Administration assist our most vulnerable populations during the pandemic. We're grateful for Commissioner Saul's dedication to public service, his focus on the customer, and value his unwavering leadership here at the Social Security Administration. And I'm honored to welcome him today to this forum. Commissioner Saul, thank you for joining us today. Please go ahead.
Yep. Stephen, thank you for that very warm and gracious welcome. And I want to thank all our participants today and wish you a very, very warm welcome to this important National Disability Forum. In the course of recent years, these forums have become a valuable stage for exchanging thoughts and capturing feedback from stakeholders and experts in their field. As you know, we continue to face challenges caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. I want to recognize the incredible job our SSA team has done to ensure the public continues to receive needed services during this time. We've made significant adjustments to address and overcome the pandemic challenges, but we are always willing to learn how we can improve and how we are looking to this forum to provide further insights. We are anxious to learn from the expert panel assembled today about your encounters, experiences, and research up to the point about COVID-19 and the mental health effect on adults and children. As always, we are capturing ideas and suggestions internally. The forum is an augmentation of that effort, and we extend that opportunity to everyone joining us today. You here have the opportunity to help us shape the future of Social Security and strengthen our disability programs. I encourage your comments, suggestions, and ideas. More importantly, we thank you for your continued investment in the National Disability Forum and Social Security Administration. I, as well as everyone with the Social Security Administration, hope you are staying safe during this challenging time, and I wish a warm welcome again to everybody. Now I'd like to turn the event over to Steve Rollins in the Office of Disability Policy to share some important information about today's forum.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Saul, and thank you for your ongoing leadership through certainly these trying and unexpected times. You've done so much to help guide the agency, and the public really hopefully realizes how fortunate they are to have you leading us through this. So, you know, as mentioned, my name is Steve Rollins. I serve as the Deputy Associate Commissioner in the Office of Disability Policy here at the Social Security Administration. I, too, would like to thank you for joining us here for what's our 17th National Disability Forum as we discuss the topic of COVID-19 and the Social Security programs, particularly the mental health effect on adults and children. I also want to thank Assistant Deputy Commissioner Stephen Evangelista for opening today's forum and giving us such insightful remarks. So before I continue, I do just want to go over a couple housekeeping items. Our moderator, Dr. Bob Drake, will guide the discussion with our panelists today. There will be an open question and answer session after the last presentation. The participant line will not, and I emphasize not, be open during the question and answer session. We are accepting questions and comments from the audience, but only via email. If you do wish to ask a question by email, please include your name, your affiliation, and your location in your email question. The email address to use is National Disability Forum, that's all one word, at ssa.gov. Again, National Disability Forum at ssa.gov. When submitting a question, please don't include any personally identifiable information such as Social Security number. We'll monitor the inbox, and we'll make sure that the questions are shared with the panel. And please feel free to submit questions or comments at any time. Our moderator, Dr. Drake, will present the questions to the panelists as time allows. If for some reason your question does not get answered during today's forum, we will make every effort to ensure that we answer it via email. The last housekeeping item I want to mention, and I guess this is the third time you'll hear this, so it must be important, right? But the call is being recorded, so remember, any statements or comments made can be and will be considered on the record. We will provide a link to the recording on our National Disability Forum website in the outreach session under the tab 4-15-2021. That's 4-15-2021. Okay, so turning to the purpose of today's forum, as with all of our National Disability Forums, you know, we're giving you, our stakeholders, an opportunity to share your unique insights, you know, directly with us, the policymakers within the agency. The forum is not intended to be a means to reach an agreement on an issue, and, you know, Social Security Administration is participating only for the purpose to gain insight through listening. But these forums do provide, you know, an opportunity for you to hear from one another, and is certainly open to anyone interested in disability policy. Now, by participating, you can help us shape the future of, you know, Social Security's disability program and our development, and certainly enlighten our continued effort, especially today, to help us address the COVID-19 within the program. Now, in today's forum, we're going to hear from medical experts and researchers about the mental health effects of COVID-19 in adults and children. We're going to, you know, the panel is going to be addressing matters involving isolation, job loss, adult functioning and impacts on their ability to work, the lack of educational structure for children, the interruption in special education services, declines in school performances, how mental health affects children and their ability to succeed, and of course, the long-term mental health-related conditions that may be likely due to COVID-19. So before I turn it over to our moderator, Dr. Drake, I'd just like to say a few words about him. Dr. Drake is a vice president for social policy and economic research with Westat. He is a retired professor of the Dartmouth Institute on Health Policy and Clinical Practice at the Geisel School of Medicine, Dartmouth. And also he's a former director of the Dartmouth Psychiatric Research Center. Dr. Drake has studied psychiatric rehabilitation for nearly 40 years. He's recognized internationally for his many contributions to transforming services toward greater alignment with client goals in the recovery process. He's co-developer of the individual placement and support model of supported employment, which really is one of the most successful and influential evidence-based practices in psychiatric rehabilitation. This is Dr. Drake's second time joining us here at the National Disability Forum. And to learn more about Dr. Drake and all of our panelists, for that matter, today, please visit the National Ability Forum website at www.ssa.gov/NDF, then click on National Disability Forums from the right side menu and select the 4/15/2021 tab. Our speaker presentations are also available there if you'd like to follow along during the discussion. So with that, we would like to extend our sincere appreciation to Dr. Drake and all of the panelists for participating in today's discussion. Dr. Drake, we welcome you, and the floor is yours. Thanks.
Well, thanks very much, Steve and Commissioner Saul. It's a real honor to be here with you folks and with such a distinguished panel. I'm looking forward to learning a lot more than I currently know, especially about the children and the effects of COVID. This is a real exciting opportunity, and I appreciate the Social Security Administration taking such leadership in this area. I'd like to join Social Security, of course, in welcoming our panelists and attendees. Today we have five panelists, each experts in their fields, and each one will have 15 minutes to present their topic. As we transition to our panel, let me just introduce them quickly. The first is Gary Bond, my close colleague and a senior study director with Westat. Following Dr. Bond is Dr. Tammy Benton, psychiatrist in chief with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and associate professor in psychiatry at the Perelman School of Medicine, the University of Pennsylvania. Next will be Dr. Calliope Holling. She's a postdoctoral fellow with the Department of Neuropsychology at the Kennedy Krieger Institute and with the Department of Mental Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Then we have Dr. Rose Perry, who's the founder and executive director of Social Creatures. And last but not least, we have Dr. Emily Troyer, general and child adolescent psychiatrist with the University of California at San Diego in the Department of Psychiatry's Hong Laboratory. As Steve mentioned, there are extensive biographies on each of these people at the ssa.gov website if you'd like to read about them. Since you will not be able to see the presentations live, we ask you to follow along as best as possible. Our speakers are going to try to remember to let you know what current slide they're on so that you can keep up with them. And with that, let me turn it over to Dr. Bond.
Thank you, Bob. Well, I am pleased and honored to be here today. Thank you, the organizers from Social Security, for inviting me. I'm going to be talking about the impact of COVID and the pandemic on adults in the U.S., especially those who have been laid off by the pandemic. I will start by mentioning a list of different factors that have really affected us all over this last year. What's kind of interesting about this talk, I'm looking at slide two now, is that these are things that we've all lived through at some level. All of us have experienced over the last year the horror of this virus and the many changes in our communities, just simply even going to a grocery store has been an adventure for all of us. Among the factors that have really affected us and affected the mental health of adults have been the infection itself of coming down with COVID and various levels of severity. The number that I got recently was 30 million Americans have tested positive, and of course the actual number who become positive is much higher. Related to the spread of this virus has been the fear that we have, the uncertainty. I remember back in March of last year, having no idea what I should be worrying about. Should I worry about the mail I get? Should it be in quarantine for 3 days? Many things that were unknown, uncertain, and very worrisome. We know also that over a half million Americans have lost their lives from the COVID, and as President Biden mentioned in his speech a month or two ago, one American out of five has lost a family member or a close friend to COVID. So the experience of grief from personal loss is very acute. There are many stresses that many people have experienced, many much more than others, of course, related to caretaking. We'll hear more about the issues related to kids in a moment. The demands of essential workers having to work in meatpacking plants and in grocery stores and restaurants and you name it, often requiring to work under conditions that are unsafe. Many sources of stress, and certainly the isolation from stay-at-home orders has been a prominent feature of the pandemic. Financial insecurity with many people unable to pay their rent or pay for even the basic necessities, and of course job loss, which I'll be going into a lot more in a second here. So if we move on to slide three, impact in terms of mental health and substance abuse symptoms has been measured in a number of national surveys, a couple here that I pulled up by an investigator by the name of Seisler has been well done. It includes a comparison, this is a national representative sample that looked at self-reported symptoms, and it compared the rates given in the survey in 2019 to first June of last year and then September of last year. It measured, among other things, anxiety, depression, substance use, and suicidal ideation, and you can see that the rates were high in 2019. One American of four in this survey reported one of those symptoms, but the key point here is that increased to 41%, a 50% increase by June of last year. A second survey in September showed that that rate was about the same. I wasn't able to find any more recent surveys to see if that has been sustained. But if you go on to slide four, a couple other related surveys, actually in this survey I just mentioned, 11% of the survey indicated they seriously considered suicide, and that rate was higher among minority groups, which the impact of the pandemic and COVID has been greater on for people of color and for women, as we, many, many studies have shown, both in terms of the risk of serious illness, but also in terms of loss of jobs and many other factors. Anyway, the rate suicidal ideation was greatly increased. A recent study actually indicated that the suicide rate in 2020 actually went down 6% compared to 2019. Those are early findings. I don't know that they will hold up, so not sure what that means. Another study found that among patients recovering from COVID, leaving the hospital, an astounding 96% reported symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The reports of anxiety and depression are higher among low-income adults, and they are high among people who have lost their jobs. We go now to slide five. One of the most dramatic and obvious impacts of COVID and the pandemic and the stay-at-home orders has been a large number of people losing their jobs and consequently high rates of applying for unemployment insurance. 75 million initial jobless claims over the last year, and this rate was much higher than the rate even in the Great Recession, which, as many will recall, was a very difficult time for workers. You can see from this graph, the green area is the monthly unemployment insurance claims, and then in 2020, the red line just shows that it goes off the charts. It's a very strange graph in that regard because of the great number who have applied. That the rate has gone down a little bit in recent months, but it's still a very high level, according to historical levels. So another way of looking at the impact on job loss in slide six, you can see a graph that shows that according to this particular analysis, 39% of workers lost a job at some point during this last year. Importantly, as of March, this analysis suggested that one-fifth of Americans who lost their jobs during the pandemic were still unemployed. Okay, so the point is a pretty simple one, and that is that the pandemic has led to a great loss of jobs during the pandemic, and some which haven't come back. And so in slide seven, some of the details about that pattern of unemployment are important. Some of the details are important. They include the fact that women and minorities have been most strongly affected, and they are among the subgroups who have not going back to a job so far. We know also that some industries have been more affected than others. What's been called the K-shaped recovery, in which some industries have not been much affected, but others have been deeply affected, and they are ones that are familiar to us, the leisure and hospitality industry, food services, and airlines. These are all pretty well known. Now let's go on to look a bit at the impact of this unemployment. In slide 8, the impact has had a huge influence on mental health. It's led to loss of self-esteem, a loss of a sense of regular routine, demoralization. Many, many studies have looked at the impact of long-term unemployment, and during this pandemic, it hasn't been any different. There have been many negative effects of unemployment that have emerged as I would say, inevitable. Now, from previous research on unemployment, there is a clear pattern across many studies that the longer that you're unemployed, the harder it is to return to work. This has been replicated in many different circumstances. And so that is a big worry about getting back on your feet as time passes. The impact on earnings is both short-term and long-term. If you have a period of extended unemployment, it's not only the immediate effects, but it is your earning power over long-term. And some research suggests that women in particular are the most likely not to return to the labor force. Slide 9 then examines the potential impact, long-term impact of unemployment in terms of applying for Social Security disability benefits. What we see in many studies is that when the local unemployment rate increases, the applications for Social Security disability benefits also increase. Pure and simple, when people can't find work, they're looking for ways to have income, and that prompts their applications. And so to look back at the Great Recession of 2008, which, as I mentioned earlier, is not nearly as bad as the current economic conditions, 1 million unemployed workers applied for SSDI, an increased number, 1 million excess, if we can put it that way, and over 400,000 actually joined the disability rolls. So slide 10 then looks at the other side of the coin. If we can help people get back to work, if people can find work, if the economy picks up, and if people regain employment, what are the benefits? Well, we see this in many studies. We see it in our work. Bob Drake and I have done work, as mentioned earlier, on the individual placement and support model of supported employment that helps people with serious mental illness gain employment, many who have not worked for many years or at all. And we see this in our studies. We see this in the general population. This is a pretty robust set of findings, and that is that employment is a real lever to help improve the health and well-being of people as they get a sense of meaning in their lives. Employment is a critical mental health intervention, is one way to put it. So studies have found that people who have previously been unemployed who gain employment not only gain greater financial security for obvious reason, but they show a reduction in mental health symptoms, substance use, and other important benefits. Turning to slide 11, I mentioned the individual placement and support model of supported employment, which is an evidence-based practice. It's an approach that Bob Drake and Debbie Becker first developed in the late 1980s and now has been studied worldwide. There have been 28 randomized controlled trials, all of which have found an advantage in terms of employment outcomes for people enrolled in IPS, that it shows an increase in employment rates, at least double in most of these studies, an increase in hours of work, the wages, job satisfaction, job tenure, across many different indicators, IPS is a way to help people gain employment. While this approach was first developed for people with serious mental illness and is provided primarily within community mental health centers, it has also been extended in the last decade to other people experiencing other conditions, people with substance use disorder, people with anxiety and depression, such as the folks that we've been talking about who have been affected by the pandemic. Several good studies of veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. And these studies have been very promising. The findings are very consistent with those for the original population. So there's not time to describe the model in much detail, but IPS is a very practical approach that helps people find a job that matches their interest and then to work finding employers who would need workers that fit that bill. And then the IPS model also includes an emphasis on integrating with mental health treatment and with other providers. So the IPS model, we believe, could be a promising approach to helping this displaced worker population. So in summary, COVID has affected the mental health of Americans in many ways, and especially in the area of employment is one key area. Displaced workers need help to regain employment, so our hope is that we can find ways to help them find that employment. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Vaughn. And so next up is Dr. Benton. Please take over whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Dr. Drake, and thank my colleague for that excellent presentation, which provided some background for my own presentation. I'm really pleased to be able to join you today. So I'm going to share with you some information about how COVID-19 has impacted children's mental health. And interestingly, in this pandemic, many people started to collect information on how COVID was impacting the mental health of our nation very early in the pandemic. And so we've gathered a lot of information, but we don't absolutely know what the long-term impacts of COVID are going to be. So if you move to the first slide, beyond my intro slide, what you'll see is a slide that references the number of children worldwide impacted by COVID. And I think this is helpful to provide some perspective on the broad impact of this pandemic. So to provide context, there are more than 2.2 billion children in the world. That's close to 30% of the world population. And about 16% of that population of young people are between the ages of 10 to 19 years of age. If you think about it, nationwide closures happened all across the world. And the closures, which have impacted over 91% of the world student population, have negatively impacted young people across the world. And early on, many asked, if we can move to slide two, many asked, what is the impact of COVID-19 on youth mental health? And they wondered if children would be affected across age groups. And if you look at this adaptation of the popular children's novel that some of you may have read to your own children, Good Night Moon, I think this describes the impact on young people. Good Night Moon, Good Night Zoom, Good Night Sense of Impending Doom. And that has been the experience of children across age ranges. On slide number four, what you'll see is a diagram, and I'm presenting this diagram because it actually represents the world in which young people live. And so there are many questions about what are the factors that have contributed to the impact of COVID-19 on young people, where there are many factors that you'll hear about today in my own presentation and in Dr. Troyer's presentation. But in this particular model, Bronfenbrenner's ecological theory is a wonderful way to conceptualize how we all live, but especially for children. And at the center of this diagram is the child. Children live in microsystems which consist of their families, their schools, their peers, all the people that are involved in their day-to-day lives, a mesosystem, which are the broader factors that impact families, like their workplaces, their work colleagues, and then broader exosystems and macrosystems, with the major point being that children live within systems, and any disruptions to any of those systems cause disruptions for young people. I'm moving on to slide number five. I'm only going to talk about this briefly because Dr. Troyer is going to talk about some of the neural impact of COVID-19 more directly. But what we do know is we know about the impact of traumatic events upon children. And in addition to the social and psychological disruptions caused by pandemics, disasters, events like COVID-19, we also know that traumatic events alters brain development for young people. And without getting into details about the specific brain structures that are impacted, we know that the pandemic and other traumatic events increase children's attention to threats or threat reactivity. And it also impacts their ability to manage their emotions or to moderate their emotions, which we refer to as emotional regulation. And this is really important. Emotional regulation is your ability to regulate and manage your feelings. So, you know, we can't have people blowing up and having a meltdown or a fight every time they're upset. And so when people are able to regulate their emotions, they're able to manage those interactions in a way that's more pro-social. We know that trauma for young people can disrupt their ability to regulate their emotions. We also know that because the brain is actively developing, multiple factors influence brain development. And so social interaction is one of them. One of the impacts of COVID-19 was lockdown and quarantine. And the data suggests that these lockdowns and quarantines or social isolation impact the developing brain. And so that brain development is impacted by disruptions in social development. And these disruptions caused by social isolation potentially influence the onset of psychiatric disorders. So the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about the broader impact of the pandemic and our response with our social activities, the activities that we took from a public health perspective to prevent the spread of COVID, actually had its own impacts on young people. So there's some things that we know from very early on in the pandemic. One is that parents and young people both agree that COVID-19 and all the related public health measures, specifically the quarantines and the lockdowns, have made their own mental health worse or much worse. That's the parents and the children. And for young people who have pre-existing mental health conditions, they have fared worse. So a majority of those young people report not only the stress of the pandemic, but disruption to their mental health services as a major contributor to declining mental health. Now, we do also know that there are different effects of the pandemic on different people presenting with specific mental health challenges, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then we also recognize that some populations have been more impacted by COVID-19 than others. And this is particularly true for minoritized youth populations who tend to be overrepresented among economically disadvantaged populations. So what are we seeing in school-aged children and adolescents? You know, what we're seeing in response to the lockdowns are chronic and acute stress reactions, increased worries and anxieties about the family's health, their own health, unexpected bereavements due to the loss of healthy family members, developmental disruptions, school disruptions, separations from their friends and disruptions of their social networks, and the unpredictable consequence of that, the homeschooling and virtual learning, has been increased internet and social media use, with parents having less ability to control those activities. And, of course, the economic worries that my colleagues talked about earlier impact entire families, and they're worried about the country. And the lockdown also for individuals in care resulted in shifts in care. So for young people with psychiatric disorders, there were shifts in care. But there were shifts in care in primary care as well. So nobody laid eyes on many children for a very long time. The next slide, I'm on slide number 8. So other effects of the lockdown for adolescents, as we know, the thing that's really been front of mind for most people are the school closures. And the school closures had other unanticipated consequences which impact the mental health of young people. So depression very often is associated with decreased physical activity, increased screen time, sleep disruption, difficulties in peer relationships and isolation. And that is what happened to many adolescents who were previously healthy without any mental health conditions during the lockdown. And the result has been for those young people who have pre-existing mental health conditions, many are doing worse. And for some young people who have no pre-existing mental health conditions, they're now experiencing more depression and anxiety. So, you know, broadly, there were other impacts of the quarantine and lockdown on youth. And one of the most significant changes is that for children who were vulnerable or at risk, they lost contact with the other adults who interacted with them on a day-to-day basis, so that resource was no longer available. Some of the other major impacts of the quarantine and the lockdowns relate to grief. So for some young people, this is their first experience with death. They've never had sick family members, but they lost these loved ones in very traumatic ways. And traumatic grief has been associated with poor outcomes. So children would see family members one day, and here they were in the hospital, and then the family member would be dead. And there was no opportunity to say goodbye, no opportunity to express grief, no visits, no rituals, no way to mourn the loss. And traumatic events for young people are associated with more complicated grief and longer grief reactions, which have been associated with worse mental health outcomes. We've also noticed that we've also seen an increase in family violence and abuse and neglect that's been reported to Childline. Now, in terms of reports of neglect and abuse, the data has been uneven. So there have been multiple reports across the world of increased family violence, mostly resulting from domestic violence. But kids haven't been in school. They haven't seen their primary care physicians. And so those people who frequently make reports haven't seen children for some time. And so we're still looking at the data around increased reports of child abuse, which has really been inconsistent and incomplete at this time. We do have reports of girls experiencing increased gender-based and sexual violence. And then, as I mentioned before, it's been hard for us to track child abuse specifically and directly because children haven't been seeing their usual care providers. You know, now another impact of the lockdowns and the quarantines has been highlighting of the disparities in care that exist within our country. minoritized youth have borne a disproportionate burden of COVID-19 compared with other populations. So Black and Latinx communities have had more adults who are lost to COVID-19. But in addition to that, the autoimmune disorder or inflammatory disorder that has been affecting young people is more common among Black and Latinx youth. So this group, this population has been impacted by COVID-19 more than other populations of youth. We also know that minoritized youth are overrepresented among lower income families. And the impact of structural racism, poverty, and barriers to care have been disproportionately impacting that population. We know that economically disadvantaged youth are at greater risk for violence, with increasing or exposure to community violence and multiple traumas, increasing risk for depression, anxiety, and suicidality, which has been worsened by the school closures. And another impact of the pandemic has been disproportionate access to online learning platforms. So even if young people have access to devices, they frequently don't have the adequate bandwidth to be able to utilize those devices in online learning. So what are we learning from the emerging data on mental health? And I say emerging because much of the data that was collected early in the pandemic were collected in online surveys where we weren't actually seeing people to collect data. So we collected a lot of data about symptoms. But what that data is telling us broadly is that among children and adolescents across studies, about between 22.6 to 43% reported depression. Close to 20 to 40% reported anxiety, and greater than 30% reported anxiety and depression. More than 50% reported moderate to severe impact on mental health. And just for the audience, we're on slide number 11. In one of the larger surveys, household surveys that have been collected by Save the Children, there's a survey of 1,500 households where they asked parents and children how they thought they were doing overall. Close to 70% of the parents reported that they were worried about their children's emotional well-being. Half of the children reported feeling bored and worried. So for younger children, boredom and worry are frequently symptoms of depression and anxiety. Doesn't mean that the child meets a criteria for a diagnosis, but those symptoms are consistent with kids who are having some depressive symptoms. About half of children, or a little more than half, reported that they're not learning enough academically, and close to three-quarters of the children reported concerns about missing out on social activities. And interestingly, in a recent study looking at college students during COVID-19, college programs looked at students who had experienced wellness initiatives focused on presenting emotional problems during COVID. And what they learned is despite those wellness-focused strategies and interventions, the college students still reported persistent negative effects on their behavioral and emotional well-being during COVID-19. Another population that you'll probably hear a little bit more about later that has been significantly impacted during this pandemic is those young people with neurodevelopmental disabilities, children with autism, ADHD, cerebral palsy. Which affects a large number of kids. So approximately 1 in 6 children between the ages of 2 to 8 years of age have some form of neurodevelopmental, behavioral, or emotional difficulty. And those individuals were placed at increased risk during the pandemic. Adolescents with ADHD would have more difficulty being at home and being on quarantine and lockdown with decreased physical activity. But most of their supports for functioning were available in school, and the same for young people with autism. The risk for those populations not receiving those services is that we see increased disruptive behaviors and other things that would increase family stress. And what we're actually seeing in the emergency departments across the United States is increasing numbers of young people with developmental disabilities presenting to emergency departments in crisis. So what are the kinds of things that help us know which kids will likely do well during a pandemic? And you know what, there are characteristics that predict resilience for children and families. And some of those predictors, they're important because we can identify them and we can leverage them to support well-being and mental health. So some kids, some predictors of resilience for children and adults and families are intelligence and cognitive ability. Families where there's positive parenting and caregiving. And so those are parents who know how to express their emotions appropriately and teach their children to do the same. Individuals who feel that they're effective individuals and that they have positive self-perceptions. People who are based in faith or faith-based community and people who have hope or religious affiliations tend to do better. Individuals who have relationships with other capable, competent, and pro-social people do better. As I mentioned before, young people with self-regulation skills and the ability to monitor and manage their emotions do well. And then young people who have effective schools. And it's important to note that because schools are one of our best partners in managing the mental health of young people. So just to summarize the high points, you know, we have some early data on the mental health impact of COVID on youth. It's not all in yet. Many of our assumptions are based on prior pandemics, but COVID will be unlike any other pandemic we've experienced. But there are things we do know, that adolescents with pre-existing psychiatric disorders are at greater risk for poor outcomes, and that is related to all the factors that have impacted young people during COVID, including disruptions of care, anxiety about the illness, and the confinement and quarantine. Young people are significantly impacted by the sudden death, the traumatic grief that's likely to follow those sudden deaths, and are much more likely to cause depression and other psychiatric disorders. Young people during COVID are at increased risk for acute stress and post-traumatic stress disorder, depression and anxiety with the lockdown, COVID-related worries, stress factors, and increased intrafamilial violence. And then emerging data suggests that COVID-related disruptions will continue to have a negative impact on the behavioral and emotional functioning of young people for quite some time. We need to pay attention to vulnerable youth who were disproportionately impacted. Removal from school for vulnerable populations has increased risk for poor mental health. That includes minoritized youth, girls, children living in poverty are at increased risk. And then the excessive internet use and social media use has increased risk for poor mental health. Now, in general, there are many benefits during COVID of the internet and social media, but unfortunately, for some youth who are vulnerable, it became one of their only means for maintaining connections, and it became harder for parents to monitor. And then what's important for us as we think about supporting families and youth during the pandemic is that we need to identify their strengths and support resilient families and children. And then for those families that are vulnerable, we need to identify their strengths and build upon those to support their recovery. But one thing that I can say for certain, and one thing that the data definitely points to, is that we can expect to see the impacts of COVID-19 on the mental health of young people for some long time after this pandemic has ended. And I'll thank you for your attention, and I'm going to end my comments at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Benton. Very good. We're next going to move on to Dr. Holing. If she's ready to go, please start.
Yes. Hi. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the invitation to speak here. I'll be talking about mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic and focusing specifically on developmental disabilities. Dr. Benton just did an amazing job of taking us through some of the literature on childhood. So I'm going to, I think, skip over a lot of that so that we have more time to focus on other topics. So I'm on slide 2 right now, looking at the outline of today's presentation. And as I just mentioned, I'm going to focus on individuals with developmental disabilities. Moving to slide 3, what I do want to say before getting into some of the empirical research is that the COVID-19 pandemic is really unique in a lot of ways from prior epidemics and, you know, national disasters or other traumatic events that have occurred on a population level. The mental health effects of these sorts of disasters and major stressors has been well established. What makes this pandemic unique is that there are ongoing outbreaks, and there wasn't really a single event that happened. Of course, the WHO declared the COVID-19 pandemic back in March of last year, but as a country and as an international community, we've certainly experienced repeated stressors and different things happening. On top of that, there have been a lot of other difficult things happening in the world. Racism, discrimination, violence towards people of color. And for individuals that belong to multiple of these minoritized populations, the combination of these sorts of stressors on top of the COVID-19 pandemic is especially difficult. Of course, the COVID-19 pandemic is global in scope, which means that we can't simply take a break by going somewhere else. Everyone is affected. And because of the infectious nature of this situation, there's been a lot of isolation. There have been challenges related to caregiving, inadequate support services, and really across the board uncertainty in terms of when things are going to end, if things are going to go back to, quote, normal, how is the world going to look like. So all of this, it really creates a unique situation that I think as a society we haven't experienced before. So instead of talking about child mental health, I'm going to go ahead and skip ahead to slide number 9. This is the title slide for the section on individuals with developmental disabilities. So looking at slide 10, I just want to take a moment to mention this really excellent letter to the editor that came out earlier this year by John Constantino and colleagues in the American Journal of Psychiatry. And I'll be touching on some of the key points that the authors make in the next slide, but I just want to invite you to take a look at this paper and read it in its entirety, because it really makes a strong case for why the pandemic has, you know, special impacts on people with IDDs. So moving to slide 11, these are some of the points that that the authors make. First is, unlike people in the general population, persons with IDDs often require in-person care or critical therapeutic support in their own living environments. And when the COVID-19 pandemic started, there was really not a whole lot of backup for these extended service disruptions. So while many of us were able to say, okay, I'm going to work from home, or I'm going to figure out how to adapt to the situation, for people that really require those therapeutic supports and services, it was a lot more challenging. Therefore, people with IDDs have experienced a disproportionate impact on the mitigation efforts and social distancing that that we all had to take part of. In addition, when we consider the school context, of course, all children and all people going to school experience challenges around this, but I think it's important to remember that special education often requires nuanced physical contact, having a person there to perhaps redirect the child. And these sorts of services and support are really quite difficult to implement in online schooling. So therefore, we can expect to see a disproportionate impact on the potential reduced quality of education in children with IDDs. In addition, the exclusive reliance on telehealth can leave a lot of gaps in terms of the delivery of appropriate health care. So of course, for all individuals, there are some things that we simply can't do online. We have to go in person to get testing or to get a procedure. But for many reasons, even something like a mental health appointment or just a check-in with the physician may be much more difficult for a person with an IDD to receive. So this has important implications in terms of not only adverse effects on health, but exacerbated inequities in this population. Related to this is the issue of access to testing and medical care for individuals infected with the virus. So something as simple as getting a blood test, blood drawn, a nasal swab, or even spitting in a tube, this may be something that some of us take for granted, but is not always an easy thing for someone to do, especially someone with an IDD. So this has important implications in terms of people being able to get tested. And then in addition, medical care can be more complicated. And this is for a number of reasons, but includes the increased risk of infection and complicated outcomes from this virus that exist in people with IDDs. For those of you who don't know, and I'll direct you to this paper by Macquarie 2020, a really excellent white paper in collaborations with Johns Hopkins, the team found that individuals with developmental disabilities were one of the groups of people that had the highest mortality rate when they contracted COVID. And this is for a number of reasons, but we know that this population tends to have a lot of co-occurring conditions, both medical as well as mental and behavioral health. And so together, these things can really complicate recovery and trajectory from COVID-19. So in short, what the authors of the paper really stated is that we need to ensure that that public decision making and mobilization of relief funds are equitably responsive to the needs and preferences and interests of people with IDDs. So with that being said, I'm going to move on to slide 12 and talk a little bit about some empirical research that I've worked on with a group of investigators at Kennedy Krieger Institute. So here we were looking at psychiatric and behavioral problems during the pandemic among children with autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. So the participants in the study were actually the parents of the children with autism that were enrolled in a clinic research registry at Kennedy Krieger in the Center for Autism and Related Disorders. The parents completed an online survey regarding what their family and their child was experiencing. And here we consider children to be between the ages of 2 up to, but not including, 17 years old. So we had a little over 250 individuals respond to this. And the goal was to identify the frequency of either new or worsening symptoms, and then also to identify risk factors for these new and worsening symptoms. So moving to slide 13, the figure on the right shows, and this is actually not meant to be totally legible, so don't worry if you can't totally see it. I'm going to highlight the key points, but that figure is showing the percent of children with a pre-existing psychiatric or behavioral health problem that experienced a worsening in their condition during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so what I've highlighted on the left is that the top conditions that worsened during the pandemic among these children with ASD were anxiety, disruptive behavior, and depression. This means that among the children that had that pre-existing condition, for example, 42 of them experienced a worsening in their anxiety. Moving to the next slide, slide 14, here what we're looking at is the onset of actually new psychiatric or behavioral symptoms in these children. So instead of looking at worsening conditions, we're looking at things that popped up that previously were not a problem for the child or weren't a diagnosed condition. And the most common things that came up were irritability, sleep problems, anxiety, and disruptive behavior. And I'll note that the onset or the frequency of these new symptoms was actually similar in children with and without pre-existing psychiatric and behavioral conditions, with the exception, of course, of autism, since all of these kids have autism. So this is pointing to, in this clinical population, some of the things to really look out for are things like irritability, problems with sleep, anxiety, and disruptions in behavior. Moving now to slide 15, our group wanted to try to understand, well, what are risk factors for this sort of thing? When we looked at this overall population of children with autism, we found that almost 60% of the children were experiencing increased psychiatric problems. And some of the key risk factors that we found were having someone in the family that had at one point received a diagnosis of COVID-19. So for those children, they in particular experienced higher psychiatric or behavioral symptoms or new symptoms. In addition, a child's understanding of the pandemic was actually related to worsening symptoms. And this is a little complicated, and we need further research on this, but it suggests that perhaps in children who understand what's going on and are really aware of all of the things changing around them, then they will be experiencing worse mental health. This is slightly in conflict with what qualitative data by Asbury et al. Showed in a paper earlier this year. They found that in children who didn't seem to understand what was going on, those children actually experienced more mental distress. So there's definitely more work that needs to be done here to understand what's going on and how to support children and families. Intuitively, a parent's own psychopathology, so their symptoms of anxiety, depression, loneliness, hopelessness, or hyperarousal, and here I'm using hyperarousal to refer to feelings of panic, parents that had those mental health symptoms were more likely to have children that experienced a worsening in their own psychiatric and behavioral problems. As Dr. Benton and Dr. Bond mentioned, sociodemographic factors are important predictors of adult and child psychopathology. And consistent with this, we found that children from low-income households were also more likely to experience these psychiatric and behavioral problems. And I should note that for all of these risk factors that I've just mentioned, they were adjusted for the other risk factors, including parent and sociodemographic factors. For example, having a COVID-19 diagnosis in the family was a risk factor for worsening mental health in the child, independent of things like the parent psychopathology and the low income. So next, moving to slide 16, I would be remiss if I did not mention this study that came out recently by SPARC. SPARC is the Simons Powering Autism Research for Knowledge. They do a lot of really wonderful work, and this study actually surveyed parents or caregivers of individuals with autism that were enrolled in the SPARC study. They had a huge sample, which I think is part of the reason why this is very noteworthy. Over 3,500 individuals responded to their survey. And I won't go into great detail about what they showed. I do invite you to look into the paper and read it yourself because it's very informative and interesting. But in brief, they found that most individuals with autism experienced significant ongoing disruptions to their therapies and other support services. And this was especially the case among children less than 5 years old. In addition to these interruptions in services and therapies, the authors found that on average, the children with autism had a worsening in their symptoms as well as moderate family distress. And so that is that's aligned with what I just reported from our own empirical work that saw these worsening symptoms in the child as well. So wrapping up this section here, I just want to conclude with some takeaways and some implications. As I said, the COVID-19 pandemic is not only serious, but it's unique, and that poses important challenges in terms of our ability to not only do research, but deliver interventions, and moving forward the implications for children and adults in the population. Although according to models from previous disasters and stressful events in the populations or epidemics, most individuals we don't expect will face long-term mental and behavioral challenges, we do expect that some minority will. And it's not clear exactly what percent of the population that will be, but that tends to be the case according to what we've seen in prior disasters and situations like this. So this really argues for the need for longitudinal data and the consideration of a developmental lens, meaning we're looking at the person, where they live, what risk factors they had during the pandemic, before the pandemic, how all of these things work together, and where they were in their development when these things were happening, right? So, for example, the effect of isolation on a person may be different depending on if the person is a small infant, a toddler, a school-aged child, or an older adult. And so, again, the need for longitudinal data is really important. And then lastly, I just want to acknowledge that a lot of the research that's come out so far has been focused on adults, and that is because it's easier to do this research, right? When a lot of us are at home and able to complete online surveys, it's much easier to provide information about how we're doing, how our mental health is, the challenges we're experiencing. But of course, children and individuals with disabilities and other populations that may be harder to access, we have considerably less data on those special populations. So I think we're starting to see the emergence of findings, but it's definitely been lagging relative to adults in the general population. So that is just about everything I wanted to say. I will point out, of course, that first section of the talk I basically skipped over, but you're welcome to look over it. And there's also a third section of this talk, which I knew I wouldn't have time to get to, but I've plugged in some slides for those of you who may be interested. This is looking at longitudinal trajectories of mental distress in U.S. adults. This is out of our group at Hopkins. And I believe on one of these slides, or maybe it's the very last slide, slide 26, second to last slide, I should say. I just give acknowledgement to our research group. And there's the URL right there for the homepage to learn more about this work and what we found and how we're doing it. So I invite you to check that out and learn more. And with that, thank you again for the opportunity to speak, and I look forward to hearing your questions later today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Holen. Our next speaker is Dr. Perry, and please feel free to take over when you're ready.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Rose Perry, founder and executive director of Social Creatures, and it is a pleasure to be speaking with you all today. I want to thank the speakers so far for setting me up wonderfully to continue this conversation and kind of talk about a lot of topics that have been covered already in a more applied setting, because Social Creatures is an applied research nonprofit. We are bringing together science education, advocacy, and innovation to ensure that any individual can stay socially connected with others no matter the circumstances. So in other words, we really care about this concept of equitable social infrastructure, which basically means that ensuring that everyone has access to the spaces, organizations, and services that shape their ability to connect with others, build relationships and social networks with others. We are a very interdisciplinary team, as you can see on slide 3. We are research scientists, clinicians, educators, writers, and creatives from across the country. I myself have a PhD in neuroscience and physiology from New York University School of Medicine, and my research has focused on the short and long-term impacts of early life adversity on child development, with a heavy emphasis on how social connections can get under the skin, so to speak, to protect individuals from the long-term negative effects of stress and trauma. So we are a fairly young organization. We are almost a year old. We launched last April with funding from the National Science Foundation in rapid response to COVID-19. We launched because we were very concerned about the psychological fallout of social distancing and school closures on child and family health. So we very quickly set up a science communication and advocacy newsletter to educate on the importance of social connection, as well as mobilize donations of computers, Wi-Fi, and low bandwidth resilient software solutions, video conferencing software solutions, to families and children that either did not have technology in the home or had very poor internet connections in the home, to help them stay connected to their school, work, and communities. So if you move on to slide 5, I'll kind of cover now why we focus so much on social connection. I'm guessing that after this past year, it doesn't come as much of a surprise to anyone listening that social connection is really important for our mental health and well-being. but this has also been backed by a lot of research that links social isolation and loneliness to higher rates of depression, anxiety, and even suicide and cognitive decline. However, what might come as more of a surprise to some of you listening is that social connection is also incredibly important for our physical health. Research has shown, meta-analysis research especially has shown that social isolation is associated with a greater risk of chronic inflammation, heart disease, and stroke. In fact, meta-analyses have also shown that individuals with weak social relationships are 50% more likely to die prematurely than people with strong social relationships. So social connection, or the lack thereof, has even been linked to our longevity across the lifespan. And as the pandemic continues, Americans are facing a loneliness epidemic. A survey in October revealed that 36% of Americans reported serious loneliness. And when you look at this data for young Americans aged 18 to 25, the rate is nearly doubled. These findings are thought to be linked to social distancing practices, with 88% of Americans surveyed reporting that they were practicing social distancing always or very often. And meta-analysis data that recently came out also indicates that quarantine heightens the risk for depression, anxiety, stress-related disorders, and anger by up to 2 to 3 times. So moving on to slide 6, we also launched with really some strong concerns around equity regarding how low-income households in particular would be impacted by COVID, especially given that social distancing really quickly shifted much of our lives and our socialization online, and low-income households are significantly less likely to have access to computers and internet in the home. As you can see on the graph that I have on slide 6, only 54% of low-income households report owning a computer in the home versus 94% of high-income households. And unfortunately, we are now starting to see statistics that low-income individuals are reporting significantly higher loneliness, stress, and worse mental health problems during COVID-19. And low-income families are having a harder time staying connected to their communities, including youth staying connected to the typical adult figures in their lives, like teachers. 36% of low-income students reported that they have had difficulties accessing school because they did not have a computer or internet in the home. So we move on to slide 7 now. We also launched our organization with child and adolescent-specific concerns at front of mind. The emergence of COVID, as has been previously mentioned by our speakers, has led to massive school closures. These school closures have impacted nearly 60 million children in the United States, disconnecting them from their peers and teachers at a developmental period where peers are of central importance, and that is critical in terms of neurodevelopment and vulnerability for the emergence of mental health disorders. Because of this, we were very concerned, and we remain concerned, that the social-emotional losses that children have been experiencing as a result of COVID are as important, if not more important, than the cognitive losses that they're experiencing as a result of school closures, because we really can't expect children to be ready to learn unless their social emotional needs are taken care of. And we really need to make sure they're returning to school, having previously addressed the chronic stress and effects of trauma that the pandemic has caused. I also want to stress that we can't talk about children's mental health without considering their caregivers' mental health and well-being as well. This is because research has shown that stress can be readily transmitted from caregivers to their children. However, so long as parents have sufficient support and resources, they can do the opposite, and they can strongly reduce and at some ages even completely block their child's physiological response to stressors. So we really need to support parents to support our children. Moving on to slide 8, unfortunately, perhaps not unsurprisingly, but unfortunately, the pandemic has led to significant mental health impacts on children and caregivers, We really aren't doing enough to support them, given these statistics. So pregnant mothers and those with young children have reported experiencing 3 to 5 times increases in anxiety and depression. A recent survey revealed that 70% of children are more overwhelmed, worried, and sad because of the pandemic. And this rate is much higher when you look at children from families earning under $50,000 a year. And since the onset of the pandemic, emergency rooms have seen a 24% increase in mental health visits from 5 to 11-year-olds and a 31% increase in mental health visits from adolescents. And while we don't really know what the long-run effects of these are going to be, it is concerning because there is prior research that shows that loneliness and disease containment measures like quarantine have been associated with future mental health problems for up to 9 years later in children, adolescents, and young adults. This research also does provide some hope, though, by showing that the supportive presence of an older peer or an adult figure helps impart resilience in the face of adversity. So with that in mind, at Social Creatures, we've been working really hard to provide support to families and children by rapidly creating social infrastructure that enables them to safely connect with loved ones and their communities via online virtual settings. We are really trying to provide support across the whole lifespan, intergenerationally from birth with our new parent support program into childhood and adolescence with our generational youth mentorship program, and spanning into adulthood, we have a seated fitness group exercise program where our oldest participant is 93 years old. And foundational to all of these programs is our Digital Safety Nets initiative, which is providing the necessary technology to support our program participants' ability to access these programs in the first place. So technology, if distributed, can be a great equalizer in many ways. I want to highlight that the key to us being able to really rapidly mobilize all of this virtual social infrastructure has been by working closely with community partners, by leveraging the trusted and established relationships that these organizations provide and have with their community members. We were able to establish quick buy-in and also, even more importantly, ensure that we were co-designing our programs and solutions with the communities themselves directly. However, moving on to slide 11, I do want to also highlight that we face substantial barriers along the way. By far the biggest barrier that we faced and continue to face is ensuring equitable access to broadband internet. As you can see on the graph on slide 11, only 56% of low-income households report having access to broadband internet, which, you know, is higher speed internet that is needed for video conferencing to occur, versus 94% of their high-income peers. And I don't know if some of you remember at the beginning of the pandemic that some major internet providers said they were opening up access to the internet for all. In our experience, this did not really translate to reality for many low-income families, at least in the communities we've been working with, because there were many unpublicized caveats associated with these announcements. For instance, if families had any outstanding debt with the companies, one family we were working with had an $8 debt. We could not set up a new account unless it was under a different adult's name who lived in that household, which became a nightmare to navigate for single-parent households. We also had initial barriers establishing caregiver buy-in for any of our child-focused programming, but when we really leaned into deploying our programs and developing our programs through our community partners, we were able to overcome this. And finally, a huge barrier that cannot go unsaid is that the need for social, emotional, and mental health supports for children and caregivers that we have seen on the ground is far outsizing the available infrastructure right now to support them that we have, and in terms of broader programming and policies that are working towards this as well. So we really need more resilient and accessible infrastructure, and this means not just having community-led grassroots initiatives, but also centralized top-down support that is providing equitable access for everyone. Moving on to slide 12, though, to talk about some happier things, despite these barriers, we have experienced many silver linings, and I just want to highlight a few examples here. COVID and the shift to living our lives more online has resulted in us finally addressing many longstanding inequities. For example, many families have received technology in their home for the first time ever due to COVID-related initiatives. We have seen that tech-enabled programming and services has made work and social lives open up to individuals with disabilities more than ever, allowing them to engage in services and entertainment and many other things that were really not very accessible to many of them before the pandemic. And we really need to make sure that we are advocating to keep these virtual and accessible options going on forever beyond the pandemic, even after in-person programming resumes for this reason. Further, we are seeing that social infrastructure, even when constructed virtually, can improve social connection and quality of life, especially for historically underrepresented communities, such as individuals with disabilities. For instance, 94% of participants in our longest running virtual program, which is our seated fitness program, half of which are individuals with a disability, report that the program has improved their quality of life in the past year. I don't know how many of you listening could say your quality of life has improved after this past year. So I know that I myself find this statistic to be incredibly powerful and revealing to how much more work there is to be done to accommodate individuals with disabilities. I really believe a major key to our success so far has been working closely with communities instead of for communities to contextualize our program creation from the ground up. This has led to the development of our core design principles, which I've listed on slide 13 for your reference. We work really hard to make sure that our program inputs and activities are, first of all, grounded in the science of social connection. So we're not just putting people online. We're really trying to guide the construction of meaningful relationships face-to-face. But also we incorporate universal design, cultural inclusivity and safety, and caregiver-forward practices that support rather than unintentionally burden our program participants and caregivers, whether they be parents, teachers, or healthcare workers. And those last three design principles were developed directly from working so closely with communities. So if anything, I hope you take the following away from this talk. The first being that supporting the social-emotional well-being of children and their caregivers is critical to mitigating the short and long-term effects of COVID for children and adolescents. We also must intentionally invest in the creation of social infrastructure, both in the physical and virtual world, to provide children and families with a multitude of ways to stay connected with their communities and loved ones. This is really important. I know that screen time is a concern for many, and we see evidence of that as well, but we need to make sure that there are safety nets in place for when in-person connections cannot occur. We need to build around that this is going to happen again. There are crises that happen in society, so investing in social infrastructure that has these virtual components is really important to building more resilient communities in the long run. And finally, in order to ensure that this social infrastructure is provided equitably at scale, we really require coordinated efforts merging both community-led initiatives with top-down centralized support via government and policies. And the more that those two can work together hand in hand, I think the more the wider net that will cast, and people will not be left behind or without safety nets in times of crises especially. So on slide 15, to put these takeaways to work, I will leave you with the following recommendations. I cannot emphasize enough how important it's been, at least in our experience, to design caregiver-forward programs and policies that are feasible, convenient, and intuitive and flexible. Parents especially have been, we've seen data presented so far today of how burdensome the pandemic has been on parents, especially women, and we need to design around that to make sure that well-meaning things aren't unintentionally harmful to those that we're trying to support. I also think we need to look at how to lower the barrier to entry for more centralized programs and policies. One great way to do this would be by advocating for parity laws across all the states, making sure that if mental health care, for example, is provided in person versus virtual, that reimbursement rates are the same. We're seeing many clinicians not providing virtual services, especially in-network providers, because they're not getting reimbursed as much for providing those services. And we could also work to advocate toward repealing laws that there are laws that exist that restrict cities from providing their own internet. But we don't have to rely on companies alone to make sure that everyone is connected. And finally, to make sure that programs and policies are benefiting everyone, we really need to invest in and collaborate directly with historically underrepresented communities, and this should include individuals with disabilities to create and strengthen social infrastructure. So with that, I just want to thank you for your time and thank the Social Creatures team who've been working around the clock for the past year, and I encourage you to reach out via my email at rose@thesocialcreatures.org. On slide 16, I have all of our contact information. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Perry. And last but not least is Dr. Troyer. Please take over when you're ready.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Dr. Emily Troyer. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. So I'm an adult and child psychiatrist and also a research postdoc fellow in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego. And in the Hong laboratory there, we focus on studying immune and neuroendocrine mechanisms in neuropsychiatric disorders broadly. So today I'm going to be focusing on the biologic effects of COVID-19 infection on the brain and how that could influence mental health outcomes. So I want to thank the Social Security Administration for inviting me to be here today, and I'm excited to be here with such esteemed panelists who have discussed a lot of the psychosocial aspects of this pandemic, which of course also affect our biology and our brains. But again, today I'll be focusing just on individuals who have been infected with COVID-19. So moving to slide 2, I just want to offer some historical perspective for the group, because in the past we've seen with particularly influenza pandemics or outbreaks that neuropsychiatric symptoms can accompany infection or can follow infection by weeks, months, or years in affected individuals. And a particularly salient example of this is something that we refer to as encephalitis lethargica, which occurred around the beginning of the 20th century, around the same time as the 1918 influenza pandemic. And encephalitis lethargica was basically an illness of confusion and excess sleepiness, where individuals could also have other neuropsychiatric symptoms like abnormalities of eye movement, depression, psychosis, catatonia. It's estimated that it affected about 1.5 million individuals globally. And within 5 to 10 years of recovery, about 80% of adult survivors went on to develop Parkinsonism. And so it's estimated that in the latter half of the 20th century, up to half of Parkinson's disease cases in the U.S. were post-encephalitic in origin. Another thing that's interesting to mention is that encephalitis lethargica had different presentations depending on the time in development when it occurred. So in children and youth who were affected with encephalitis lethargica prior to puberty, they tended to have hyperactive or externalizing manifestations, and our modern conceptions of things like ADHD and conduct disorder, for example, are derived at least partially from what we learned about brain and behavior relationships from encephalitis lethargica. Conversely, individuals who were affected by encephalitis lethargica as adults almost always had hypoactive or slowed neuropsychiatric presentations like depression and Parkinsonism. And so there's this developmental specificity that's difficult to understand. The other thing to note is we still don't know the cause of encephalitis lethargica because it occurred in parallel with the 1918 influenza pandemic. It's thought to be related to it, but cellular and molecular techniques were not then what they are today, and so there really is no way of knowing definitively what was the cause of this illness, but typically people think that maybe this was a post-infectious immune-mediated disorder akin to what we now know as autoimmune encephalitis, for example, but to be clear, we're not sure. And moving on to slide 3, I just want to share this quote with the group because I think it's particularly salient. This is actually, this is testimony from a physician to the New York City Welfare Council in 1935. And this physician is discussing patients following encephalitis lethargica. And the quote says, "The outcome for almost all EL patients was some form of tragedy, death, trouble with the law, inability to maintain stable relationships within their family or with others, physical disability, incarceration as children or young adults in mental hospitals and geriatric homes. The social aspects of EL concerned investigators and governments from around 1920, when it became clear that for a majority of patients, at least, there was no true post-EL period, as full recuperation could not be expected. Recovery was often defined as the ability to work, even where this meant, for example, that a former teacher was now employed to undertake restricted gardening activities. Physical incapacity was a problem for most patients, whether because of Parkinsonism or other neurologic symptoms, or because the long-term mental effects, bradyphrenia, memory lapses, lack of concentration, prevented resumption of their pre-EL occupations." And so I wanted to share this with the group to just provide some context for the fact that we're in an unprecedented global pandemic, and in the last viral pandemic of this scale, one takeaway is that a significant portion of the post-pandemic disability is related to neuropsychiatric function. And so I think that this pandemic similarly is probably going to be with us for quite some time. So moving on to slide 4, we can see that we'll skip over a lot of the influenza outbreaks and move on to past coronavirus outbreaks. And so a meta-analysis by Jonathan Rogers and colleagues last year looked at neuropsychiatric outcomes following hospitalization for severe infection with either SARS-CoV-1 or the MERS coronavirus. And what they showed is that acutely, almost a third of people hospitalized had confusion during the acute illness. And at a post-illness follow-up, which was a mean of 3 years later, about 19% still had post-illness memory impairment. In terms of mood, about a third had depressed mood during the acute illness. And at 3 years post-illness, 15% met criteria for depression. 32% had PTSD at the long-term 3-year post-illness follow-up. And psychosis was less common, but was seen both in the acute illness and at follow-up. And I think a big takeaway from this paper is they showed that from these SARS and MERS survivors, 23% of them had not returned to work at 3 years post-illness. So moving on to slide 5, I just want to put this here as a reference for everybody. There are thousands and thousands of papers that are coming out about the effects of COVID-19 on the brain, and it can be almost impossible to keep up with this growing literature. So there's a blog that's maintained by the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry, where they do a weekly synthesis of all the papers that are published related to COVID-19 in the brain. And so this is a really awesome resource for anybody who's interested in kind of keeping up with that literature. So now I'm on slide 6, and I just want to look at kind of a broad overview of what we know about COVID-19 and neuropsychiatric disorders. And from the bird's eye view of the epidemiology, we're starting to appreciate that there's a bidirectional relationship in that COVID-19 infection is associated with development of neuropsychiatric symptoms, but also pre-existing neuropsychiatric disorders might influence COVID-related outcomes. So in the first direction, we see that in large EMR databases like the TriNet-X database, almost a quarter of patients with confirmed COVID have at least one neuropsychiatric complaint. In the first 3 months post-illness, about 20% of survivors have a neuropsychiatric complaint. And a paper just came out last week, which is not here on this slide. The same group looked at the incidence of neuropsychiatric disorders in 6 months after infection in survivors, and they found that an even higher portion, about a third, have at least one neuropsychiatric complaint. And moving on to slide 7, we see that in the opposite direction, a pre-existing neurologic or psychiatric disorder is associated with increased risk of COVID infection, hospitalization for infection, and even COVID-related death. So on slide 8, I'll talk a little bit about COVID-19 and cognition. Delirium is a confusional state experienced by a portion of patients hospitalized for any critical illness. It is associated with risk for mortality and functional and cognitive decline. And we're seeing that in studies right now, up to 65% of studies, or up to 65% of people who have COVID have delirium at the time of hospitalization. Up to 80% of survivors still have cognitive impairment at the time of hospital discharge. Even mild COVID has been associated with cognitive deficits. And unfortunately, pre-existing dementia is an independent risk factor for COVID-19 infection and poor outcomes, particularly in the case of vascular dementia and particularly in African Americans with vascular dementia. And on slide 9, we look a little bit at depression. So right now, studies are suggesting that about 13 to 42% of patients with COVID are presenting with depressed mood. And interestingly, rates of depression don't appear to be related to the severity of COVID illness. So it may not be the case that more severe COVID infection is associated with higher risk for depression, for example. We see similar rates of depression even in patients who had milder infection or who did not require hospitalization. And it's also important to note that, as several of the speakers have pointed out, that a large proportion of society in general is reporting increased symptoms of depression. So I think going forward, it's going to be important to try to disentangle what degree infection versus other pandemic-related stressors confer risk for depression. If we move on to slide 10, some others have also discussed that COVID infection is associated with high rates of PTSD. So the prevalence of this varies widely, up to 96% of patients being discharged after hospitalization for COVID have PTSD symptoms. And it's important to note that outside of COVID, an ICU hospitalization is associated with about 20% prevalence of post-ICU PTSD. So we think that right now the prevalence does seem to be a little bit higher than that with COVID-19. And unlike depression, PTSD does appear to be associated with severity of COVID infection. So the more severe infection you have, the more likely you are to have symptoms of PTSD. And interestingly, PTSD symptom severity also predicts duration of COVID-19 recovery from other physical and respiratory symptoms. So I think this is going to be an important thing to monitor going forward. And on slide 11, I talk a little bit about COVID-19 and psychosis. We don't have good data on the prevalence of psychotic symptoms in COVID-19 patients. It was seen in a minority of patients hospitalized for SARS and MERS, and there are case reports of this now, but it's not something that we have a good understanding of in terms of the exact prevalence. It is important to note that schizophrenia, an illness where psychotic symptoms are prominent, is associated with increased risk for COVID and COVID-related complications. And unfortunately, studies in multiple countries have also shown that individuals with schizophrenia have decreased odds of ICU admission for COVID-19. And so this raises the issue of potential disparities in medical care for individuals with pre-existing serious mental illness. And so it's important to note that, you know, I've talked about a variety of symptoms so far. We're still sort of in the time of emerging data in regard to prevalence of these things. And like others have pointed out, most of this data has been in adults so far. But how do we make sense of how COVID could cause these diverse types of neuropsychiatric symptoms? On slide 12, I've posted a visual here of multiple different ways in which COVID could affect brain function. And we've all heard that COVID is associated with strokes and things like that. So it is definitely the case that COVID infection can influence blood clotting and therefore blood flow to different parts of the brain. It's a respiratory illness. So people will have various degrees of hypoxia or low oxygenation, which will affect different parts of the brain. And we're also seeing that in some cases, individuals have evidence of demyelination with COVID infection, so that could affect the way the brain sort of signals to itself across different parts of the brain. And even in the absence of these major neurologic lesions, we know that infection or stress or any type of inflammation in the body is signaled to the brain. And the brain has immune cells itself. So anytime we have infection or inflammation, unfortunately, the brain shifts its energy away from producing neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. So that all of those things could contribute to the types of diverse neuropsychiatric symptoms that we're seeing in people who have COVID-19 infection. The short version of it is we don't know exactly how COVID is causing these symptoms, but it's probably multifactorial. And then on slide 13, I just want to point everyone's attention to, again, to this issue that most of what we know about neuropsychiatric symptoms in COVID is based on work with adults. And I want to talk about the maternal immune activation hypothesis, which is pictured here, and I know that some of you may or may not be able to see the slides, but basically what we know from some human studies and from work in animal models is that exposure to inflammation, regardless of the cause, if it be from stress, infection, or parental immune-mediated disorders, exposure to inflammation in utero increases an individual's risk for developing neurodevelopmental disorders like autism or schizophrenia over time. And in animal work, there's also some evidence to suggest that infection, inflammation, and stressors in childhood will also mediate this risk for neuropsychiatric disorders over time. So right now, we don't have any evidence to suggest that COVID exposure in utero, for example, causes major nervous system abnormalities, like Zika virus, for example, caused obvious and major neurologic abnormalities for in utero exposed infants. That doesn't seem to be the case with COVID, but I think it's important to remember that we haven't had the opportunity yet to follow neonates or young children exposed to COVID either in utero or early in life over a long enough period of time to really appreciate whether or not this is going to affect the incidence of neurodevelopmental or neuropsychiatric disorders in the coming decades. And on slide 14, this is just a picture of some of the neurodevelopmental processes that are going on in the brain, which others have alluded to as well, that the timing of an insult, whether it be a stressor, inflammation, or infection, matters for brain development. So you have neurogenesis and proliferation, migration, synapse formation, things like that happening largely in utero. But some of those neurodevelopmental processes, particularly myelination, is ongoing throughout adolescence into young adulthood. And so the effect that a stressor or inflammation can have on neurodevelopment is going to be different depending on when in development it occurs. And on slide 15, I've just showed that early evidence from the UK where they looked at basically cases of neuropsychiatric symptoms in individuals infected with COVID. You can see here that there's a graph on the left showing that the age distribution of altered mental status of cardiovascular origin is occurring in an older age distribution than compared to altered mental status of a non-cardiovascular origin. And so I think, again, this just points to the fact that different neurodevelopmental or neurodegenerative processes are ongoing at different points in time. And so I think we don't yet know what the effect of COVID infection will be on brains of at various points in development. Okay, so on slide 16, just want to summarize and to end, I've talked a little bit about we're starting to realize that COVID is associated with risk for exacerbation or new onset of several types of neuropsychiatric symptoms, particularly in adults. We're seeing cognitive dysfunction, depression, and PTSD. And pre-existing neuropsychiatric disorders like dementia, particularly vascular dementia, schizophrenia, and also autism, as alluded to by others, are associated with increased risk for COVID. And worse prognosis. And long-term surveillance of COVID survivors or neonates and children exposed to infection at various points in development will be needed to really understand the full burden of this pandemic over the coming years and decades. And we need to try to get a handle on what are the mechanisms that are involved. At this point, it doesn't seem to be the case that in most cases, the virus isn't actually entering the brain, but may be causing this cascade of other events, like clotting abnormalities and lack of oxygenation, which could contribute to neuropsychiatric symptoms. We don't have treatment specifically for COVID-19-related neuropsychiatric symptoms at this point, but particularly as providers, we need to be prepared to screen and treat symptoms on a much larger scale, I think, compared to what we're used to seeing. And on slide 17, I have a picture here of my grandparents who at the ages of 87 and 92 were both infected with COVID in December of 2020. And my 92-year-old grandfather survived, but my grandmother did not. and I actually learned that she passed away one day after I learned that she had tested positive for COVID. And so I think my personal experience definitely mirrors what others have talked about in terms of the social, psychosocial ramifications of this pandemic and the grief, the sudden grief associated with it. So I want to take an opportunity just to acknowledge all of us who have been personally impacted by this pandemic. And that's all I have for today. So thank you for your attention, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Troyer. Excellent presentation. I really appreciate it. All of these have been informative and exciting and new information for me, and I'm sure for much of the audience. We appreciate it very much. We want to open the conversation for questions, and let me remind you that if you wish to ask a question, you do so at the email address, and please include your name, affiliation, and location in your email. Now, as I understand it, somebody is going to signal me about what are the questions as they come up. But I'm not quite sure how that happens.
Yes, this is Gary Bond.
Where are we seeing the questions?
In the chat box, Bob. You have to go to the little picture with the, it looks like a conversation. Anyway, a question came in. I'll read it.
Okay.
With regard to IPS, can you comment on whether these programs are competitive employment or would you consider them subsidized or accommodated employment? IPS refers to the supported employment program that I briefly described in my talk. IPS is individual placement and support. The answer here is very definite that IPS emphasizes regular jobs in the community, competitive employment, open employment, goes by different terms, a job that anybody can hold. And the research is very good for IPS, as I said, and I believe would extend to displaced workers who were affected by a pandemic. In terms of the research on subsidized employment, my impression is that, to oversimplify, if you help people get a job through a subsidy, that the employment rates are fine as long as you subsidize the employment. But once those are removed, the jobs tend not to continue, partly because the employer may not continue a job that is originally subsidized through the government, as they do in Denmark and other European countries, and has been done in a number of demonstration projects in the U.S. I admit that I haven't reviewed the literature on subsidized employment in great detail, so there may be exceptions to what I just said about subsidized employment. But with regard to IPS, it's definitely about competitive employment.
Thank you. We have a question for Dr. Benton here. You said that isolation and other impacts of COVID have impacted brain development and emotional regulation in some children. Will they be able to recover, or are these lasting scars? Will treatment be needed to recover?
So I think in response to the very specific question about COVID-19, we really don't know what the long-term impacts are going to be. What I can say in general is the beauty of the child brain is it's developing. And so we have many opportunities to intervene early around anything that causes an insult. So clearly, for some young people with neurodevelopmental disorders, our interventions are not going to make those go away. But what we do know is that the young brain is actively developing throughout childhood and adolescence and young adulthood and onward, and very actively during childhood and adolescence. So that what we do know is, particularly around things like emotional regulation, behavioral strategies, there are interventions that we can implement for kids who have been exposed to traumatic situations that will dramatically improve outcomes. The major things that are important, though, is that the intervention happens early and that it's targeted and specific. And so, you know, for young people who are experiencing sequelae of COVID, such as depression and anxiety, we actually have treatments for all of those disorders. And, you know, with adequate treatment and consistent treatment, work with parents to support healthy development, children do fine. But we have to intervene, okay, and we have to provide the support that's needed.
Thank you. So now there's a question for Dr. Holing. With the increase in individuals needing support, what type of information would we see in medical records, given the barriers to care you expressed? Any insight on how we might determine if they would persist outside of the health crisis? With the barriers expressed to gaining services and support to claimants, are there alternative sources of information we should look to for regarding functional abilities? Can you expand on how this might differ based on impairment and racial background?
Yeah, so to be honest, I'm not sure I fully understand the whole question. So I'm going to do my best to respond, and if others on the call want to add anything, please, I welcome you to do that. So in terms of the increase of people needing support, what do we see in medical records? I'm not sure a lot of this information is necessarily going to be captured in medical records. I think, certainly if providers are, serving patients about some of the issues they're facing at home or in the schools, that may come up. I'm thinking of Kennedy Krieger Institute, where I work, where we have something called the Developmental Questionnaire, which is a survey that parents fill out prior to bringing their kids in for an appointment. And it asks about a lot of things going on at home, with the child's development in school and support services, things that would not otherwise be captured in a medical record. So I think those sorts of questionnaires are good opportunities to understand barriers and what families need. And then in terms of how this might differ in terms of impairment and racial composition, I think certainly we would expect to see greater barriers to, in terms of healthcare and access to, quality education and things like that, greater barriers for populations who are, historically more minoritized, for lower income families. And I think that includes people of color, Black, African American individuals, Hispanic, Latino, for example. And then in terms of, child impairment, certainly, the child's particular diagnoses and co-occurring conditions are also going to influence their ability to access care and the supports they need. So I apologize if that's a bit of a vague answer. I'm happy to clarify if there's something more specific you're looking for.
Well, thank you. So here's a question for Dr. Perry. Did your suggestions on broadband take into account the use of smartphones? And is the use of broadband targeted just at students for school, or do you recommend the use of social media to reduce mental concerns for students?
Yeah, these are great questions. I'm going to start off by addressing the second part, but then I'll circle back. So at least for me, my recommendations around the use of technology for kids definitely expands beyond school. The key thing is that we really need to think about how to use technology to mimic real life in-person social interactions to the extent that is possible. So face-to-face interactions being really the gold standard here to try to make sure that kids are having face-to-face interactions with the typical loved ones and adults in their lives, even as they remain, you know, physically distanced from them. This is really important. And even if you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations around screen time, they will say that at least even in early life, no screen time at all for the first 18 months, unless it's FaceTime or Skype with other family members, which really speaks to this point of how technology can be used in a really fruitful way for children if you are using it as an extension of real-life interactions. And with that in mind, yes, we have considered smartphones. When we look at digital divide data, unfortunately, children from lower-income households still do have less access to smartphones and tablets relative to their higher-income peers, but the gap is a bit smaller. But where we really see the issue is having sufficient data plans on the smartphones to make sure that they can have access to video conferencing software that would be needed for face-to-face interactions to occur. And one of our partners, the Family Room, has been tackling this issue for a while, well before the pandemic, and that's been great because we've been able to partner with them really strategically to use their video conferencing software that was designed to be used in really low data plan settings, low bandwidth internet situations, so that we could have children staying connected with loved ones face-to-face, even if they have very limited data plans on their smartphones.
Okay, thank you. We have a question for Dr. Troyer next. Regarding presence of neuropsychiatric exacerbation or new symptoms post-discharge, do we have information on post-discharge follow-up? In particular, does it look like duration is likely to be long-term, or is there evidence suggesting either a window of improvement or that it's likely to be progressive?
Yeah, so thank you for this question. I think the short answer is we don't know in the case of COVID-19. I would say the largest studies that we have are in the TriNetX database, which is several million EMR enrollees. And the longest follow-up we have in that database so far, we have during illness, in the 3 months post-illness, and then in the 6 months post-illness. And what we see from 3 to 6 months post-illness is the incidence of a neuropsychiatric disorder increases from about 18% at 3 months to almost 30% at 6 months. But in the scheme of things, this is a really short-term follow-up, because if you look back to prior pandemics, particularly in the case of Parkinsonism after encephalitis lethargica, that was years to decades after the end of that epidemic. And so I think it would be very premature to say that we have any kind of understanding of whether or not any of these are going to be reversible. A couple things to point out, though, in the six-month follow-up from the TriNetX database, The neuropsychiatric outcomes they're looking at include things like dementia, which we understand to be progressive. So I think if you look at individual diagnoses, you could probably speculate about the reversibility of that issue. Depression and anxiety, for example, might be more targetable, more reversible than something like dementia or stroke. And so I think it depends on the type of outcome. The other thing to keep in mind is in those large studies of the TriNetX database, the youngest enrollee is 16 years old. And so we really have next to no data on what are the neuropsychiatric outcomes in children, for example, who had MISC or who had COVID exposure. And so those are going to be important data points.
Okay.
going forward.
Thank you. So next we have a question for all of you who are studying children. And the question reads, does the panel foresee significant changes in the structure of education? For example, will schools need a liberal policy to permit mass repeating of grade level when students can return to full time to make up for what was lost during the pandemic? Should schools allow extra eligibility years for athletes who lost opportunities to address the potential of increased mental impact on those students?
This is Calliope Holing. I can provide just a couple quick thoughts. First of all, I'm cautiously hopeful that things that we've learned from the pandemic can be helpful in terms of changing the educational system moving forward. And I think that includes more inclusive teaching strategies, more flexibility for students who, may be facing a variety of challenges. Personally, I'm of the opinion that it would be great for schools and employers and really people across the board that are in a position to make these kinds of changes to consider exercising flexibility and considering the important impact that the pandemic has had on people's ability to work and to attend school and that sort of thing. And I think this is especially important considering that the pandemic has had disproportional impact on certain populations. So I think policies that that sort of give people grace and acknowledge these difficulties, I think will go a long way in terms of potentially reducing inequities going forward.
This is Dr. Perry. I want to chime in here as well. Fully agree with Dr. Holling here. And also, I definitely don't have specific policy recommendations other than agreeing about making things more flexible. But I do have concerns that children are going to be more likely to maybe be passed on to grades without having learned key cognitive things that they need to learn. I'm more concerned about that going unnoticed. So I really think that we need to look at centralized one-on-one support. I know a lot of great groups are working on high-dosage tutoring for after school and summer school as well to really help children catch up. And the other comment that I wanted to make actually bleeds into another question that just came through in the chat for me, asking me to speak about how families, caregivers, and professional social human and services staff who support them can receive some support to help keep the loved ones or client and themselves solid during this overwhelming time in our lives, which all goes together with what I was going to say on the education front, that we really need policies that are reforming and supporting reforming systems to support teachers. We've seen teachers be overburdened during this time, have more than ever that they've had to deal with on their plates, many of them being parents themselves. I think this also definitely has to do, we see similar things happening with professional social and human services staff as well. And I don't have recommendations on the individual level because I don't think you can really easily treat burnout with asking the person to do more. I think we need centralized top-down support and actual policies and systemic change that are addressing burnout and not putting that burden on the individual.
Thank you. But I think you've lost sound, Dr. Benton.
I'm sorry. Thank you. So I just want to say that many of the schools actually have set up extended learning for the summer for young children. And many of the schools are starting to extend the athletic season, so there's opportunities for those youth who lost that year to be able to compete and be attractive to colleges. So there really does appear to have been quite a bit of focus on helping children return to school and to try to manage the things that they've lost so that they can continue to move forward as we move through this pandemic.
Thank you very much. There's another question about is there research going on that might help some of these kids and adults? And I wanted to ask the whole panel this question. You know, the field of psychiatry has a long and inglorious history of providing treatments that turn out to be completely ineffective and sometimes harmful. And I hope all of you who are studying long-term course and looking at some of these interventions are keeping track of data and thinking about it as scientists as well as caring clinicians. Any comments?
What? I think Dr. Troyer and I would agree that we are trying to do no harm. I make a few comments, and Dr. Troyer and anyone else should comment as well. So in the approach to COVID, as we've worked with young people, we have taken the approach that's more consistent with the public health pyramid, so that there are a lot of young people who are resilient. They have resilient families. They have resources. They have good schools that are supportive. And those kids will do fine, and they won't need that much. They'll need community support. There's that group in the middle who will need more. And they may be kids who were doing fine prior to the pandemic. The pandemic happened, and it knocked them out, overstressed their systems, and now they're struggling with things like depression and anxiety. And then for those young people, treatment in the community, psychotherapy, for those who have moderate to severe depression or anxiety, they might need medication management, but those kids will pretty much need targeted treatment in the community. And then there's that group at the tip of the iceberg, and they're the smallest group at the peak of the pyramid, the ones who were at risk for psychosocial reasons or biological reasons or whatever those reasons are. They will require more intensive intervention. And those are the kids that right now are landing in our emergency department. So as you may know, children's hospitals and children's psychiatric programs across the United States are flooded with kids awaiting treatment. And most of those kids we're finding in the community. But it's a small number of kids who are really going to need much more focused intervention. And then the best thing we can do is identify those resilience factors in young people. What are the strengths in their families? What community supports are in place? Do they play sports? Do they go to church? Do they have friends? Do they do drama? You know, all the things that, you know, keep kids engaged and active. And so that, it has to be a public health approach to how we support folks through the pandemic. So that, those are my thoughts, and I'm sure, Emily, you have yours. So, and we're doing no harm, Dr. Drake. I just want you to know that.
Yeah, this
That's
is
what we always believe.
So this is Dr. Troyer, and I just want to say I completely agree with Dr. Benton. I think the big takeaway for me is that, you know, there are no COVID-specific neuropsychiatric treatments on the horizon. And so we really have to think about how to use what we have. And so I think that's what, you know, Dr. Benton is really describing. And I would say that in addition to that, for people who are infected with COVID, there are a few small studies here and there to suggest that individuals who are taking antidepressant medications, for example, in one study had lower risk of ICU admission and intubation. And so what if, you know, a psychiatric medication or medications that we've been using for a long time are helpful not only for the neuropsychiatric sequela, but also for the COVID infection itself. And conversely, some studies are showing that people hospitalized for COVID who receive immune modulating medications that block the cytokine storm associated with COVID have lower risk of depression. So I'm excited about the silver lining of this pandemic and the neuropsychiatric effects that we're seeing is I think it's going to really bring to light that this division between your physical health and your mental health is sort of a false dichotomy. You know, the brain is an organ that exists in the body with all the rest of the organs. And when your heart and your lungs get hit, your brain gets hit too. And so hopefully this will help destigmatize mental health and also offer us an opportunity to understand how some treatments that we use for general and psychiatric health might be useful in more domains than we had previously appreciated. So I hope that's a silver lining to this pandemic.
I hope you'll study those interventions carefully to make sure that you're really doing good. Gary, did you want to respond to that also, or are you picking on the next question?
The next question.
Okay, go ahead.
So I'll add, the question is, this is Gary Bond. The question is, are there unique mental health implications of COVID-19 for underserved or disadvantaged communities and individuals? Well, as the panelists, all of us have suggested, COVID-19 has differentially affected underserved and disadvantaged communities, so this would imply that we need to give special attention to these, just as the Biden administration has a targeted outreach to disadvantaged communities. I think that would be a smart idea for the mental health community to make sure that the adequate services, and as Bob has just been suggesting, evidence-based services are available to these communities.
Okay, great. That will be our last question. I want to thank all of our panelists for doing a great job and even responding to my inadvertent question. Appreciate it. At this point, I want to turn it over to Steve Rollins again, the Deputy Associate Commissioner in the Office of Disability Policy. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, and thank you, Dr. Drake, and thank you to all of our panelists for sharing your insights and research with us today. The information and the insights you provided will certainly go a long way in helping us develop our disability policies so we can address the challenges, continue to address the challenges presented by the COVID pandemic, you know, challenges that many of our disability claimants, you know, have faced and obviously will continue to face. I'd also like to express my condolences to Dr. Troyer for your grandmother. The experience you shared really humanizes the impact of COVID, and I believe many on this call have, you know, undoubtedly felt and experienced the same. So please accept the condolences for that. So before we close out today's forum, it's my privilege to introduce a new member to the Social Security Administration executive team, Kilolo Kijakazi, who became the Deputy Commissioner for the Office of Retirement and Disability Policy this past January. Kilolo comes to us with a wealth of policy experience and possesses specialized knowledge and experience in the areas of economic security, social insurance policy, and retirement policy. She holds a PhD in public policy from George Washington University. She was a program officer at the Ford Foundation and served as a board member for a number of boards, including as a member for the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, for the National Academy of Social Insurance, for the Policy Academies, and for Liberation in a Generation. Most recently, Kilolo served as an institute fellow at the Urban Institute, where she developed collaborative partnerships to expand and strengthen the Urban's rigorous research agenda, effectively communicate findings to diverse audiences, and to recruit and retain diverse research staff at all levels. She also conducted research in the areas of economic security, structural racism, and the racial wealth gap. So, Kilolo, we welcome you to Social Security and to your first National Disability Forum. The floor is yours. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve, for your really warm welcome, and what a tremendous first national disability forum. I want to echo Steve in his condolences to Dr. Troyer. My family also lost my brother to COVID, so this is just touching way too many families, and it'll be good to get on the other side of this and to learn from you in terms of addressing the aftermath of this pandemic. I'm glad to be a part of the Social Security Administration team and the National Disability Forum. Dr. Drake and all of the panelists, you have far exceeded our expectations today with your presentations on mental health and the effects on adults and children. The information that you've shared will help our agency, particularly our policy experts, as we shape the policy for COVID-19 and strengthen our disability policy development. I, too, would like to thank everyone for joining us today and could not have completed this National Disability Forum without your unwavering support. And I also want to thank those behind the scenes who make the National Disability Forum happen. We appreciate your hard work also. Before we close, let me share a few important agency updates. In March, we updated our website with an exciting new feature. Disability claimants and their appointed representatives can now complete, sign, and submit the SSA Form 1696, Claimant Appointment and Representative Online. This feature is secure, it's free, and it's convenient. The claimant and appointed representatives can use a mobile device or computer to submit the form. We will continue to accept the form through appeals and electronic record express or ERE portals and paper submissions via mail, fax, and e-fax. Information about the new feature is available on our website at www.ssa.gov/representation. Again, the website is www.ssa.gov/representation. Also in March, we announced our interest in establishing partnerships with local level organizations to assist with claims taking and referrals to our local offices from claimants of vulnerable populations. Vulnerable populations include those who are experiencing homelessness, limited English proficiency, are aged, deaf or hard of hearing, have a mental illness, and also those who have substance use disorders. These groups typically rely on us for in-person service and need third-party assistance. Over the past year, we have seen fewer filings for SSI and SSDI benefits. The need for your assistance could not be greater. With your help, we will enhance our ability to connect more eligible people to benefits. Organizations that are interested should contact the Social Security Regional Communications Director, RCD, in their area. Contact information for our RCDs is available at www.ssa.gov/agency/rcds.html. And again, that's www.ssa.gov/agency/rdcs.html. Finally, everyone who registered will receive an email with an evaluation regarding today's National Disability Forum. So please complete the evaluation to let us know your thoughts about the forum and future topics you would like to share. Complete the evaluation And you'll help us to improve the National Disability Forum. We are actively planning the next forum, and you'll receive details via email about this. With that, our forum has concluded. So please enjoy the rest of the day and stay safe.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.